Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by Toronto drag performer and media critic, Allison Chains.
Hi, hello. So good to be here. Good day, kia ora.
Welcome to the show. And filmmaker, drag performer, and actor, Champagne. Welcome to the show, Champagne.
Oh, hi, hello.
So today we're going to be looking at the Outback, and King's Cross in the 60s and 70s was dicey. The center of Sydney's red light district and dominated by gangsters with nicknames like Mr. Sin, you wouldn't
Same.
Think, yeah, is that what people call you, Mr. Sin?
Yeah, out of drag.
Beautiful. So you wouldn't think this would be a place for a fun night out for Ma and Pa suburbia. But you would be wrong. The Carousel Club on the corner of Darlinghurst Road and Roslyn Street was built to house the fabulous Lay Girls Cabaret by notorious Australian underworld figure Abe Saffron. The cabaret was a massive smash and attracted a wide audience who wanted to see some of the best showgirls that Sydney had to offer. Had either of you heard of Lay Girls before?
No, honestly, I had not.
I think I had, but only because of the context of looking things up from this movie. Yeah.
I mean, this is iconic. And if you go on YouTube, there are a number of their performances from the 90s that have been recorded. And they are like straight up showgirls. They're in sequin corsets. Mm-hmm. They're in feathers. There's glitter.
Yeah,
there's so
I've
much
watched
glitter.
Them. It's wild.
They're really, really good. And they were also, of course, a drag show. And of course, female impersonators, mm-hmm. as they say in Australia, which we do not really use that term here in North America. And the review was this grand day out for suburbanites and hen nights, which is another term I love that we do not use here in North America. And it was so popular because a lot of these people did not realize they were watching female impersonators. In fact, they thought they were just watching really good showgirls.
Oh, yes. I love the slight turn.
Yeah, I love nothing more than a good dose of trickery with my drag.
Isn't that funny? Yeah, we're going to be getting that into that in one of the films that we are talking about today. And of course, the crown jewel of the show was Carlotta. Now, Carlotta is not only an incredible performer, and again, you can see her work on YouTube. She's amazing. She's also an early pioneer for transgender rights. And although she wasn't the first person to receive sex reassignment surgery in Australia in the 70s, she was certainly one of the most public. And her presence in the media and willingness to become an Australian media icon helped to usher in a general social acceptance. And now, despite the acceptance that the review garnered these performers and the LGBTQA2S+ community in general, gay sex was still illegal in Australia until 1994, the year of these movies, and in Tasmania until 1997. The Carousel Club and the Lay Girls Review was still an extremely dangerous place to work. It was, after all, run by mobsters. And the establishment sold stolen liquor and cigarettes, and Carlotta's biography talks about the regular abuse of performers, including one girl who was hit over the head with a chair when she tried to quit. And there's even a 40-year-old missing persons probable murder cold case that's associated with the establishment that's
wow.
like a big thing. It's a journalist who was trying to unload things, and she
oh
was
my
that was the last place she
oh
was seen
no.
was the Carousel Club. That's a whole other rabbit hole people can
oh.
go down. And this is something that's always been fascinating to me about drag performance in general, because despite its like overt sexuality of the art form and often the seediness of the establishment, I went many, many times to the Odyssey in Vancouver and saw things I should not have seen in the bathroom. It really seems to be a bridge to mainstream acceptance, at least for a brief period of time. It happened in the 70s with Carlotta, and it's happening now with Drag Race. And of course, it happened in 1994 with a little film that was based on the Lay Girls Review. In fact, the movie directly name-checks it as one of the characters was an original Lay Girl. The Carousel Club closed in 1993, and The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, was released in 1994, supposedly inspired by the Lay Girls hitting the road after the closure of their venue. It was a mega hit, garnering huge box office, Oscar nominations, and a boffo Broadway musical, which we're going to talk about. I remember watching this with my dad when I was a tween. I think I was like 12. And even then, it was difficult to watch with him. He was very particular about his films. And it has a lot of sex, drugs, and violence that we had to have a conversation about afterwards. In fact, the movie ends with one of the characters' 7-year-old child watching his dad perform in an establishment we've already seen contains violence towards him. But it's also amazing costumes, colors, fun musical numbers, and of course, ping pong balls. Who can forget? So for me, it's really a movie about resilience and celebration in the face of a cruel outside world, which is why I think it hit so big. Champagne. What is Priscilla, Queen of the Desert about if people have not seen it for some reason, which they should?
Listen, in my humble opinion, I do believe that Priscilla, Queen of the Desert is the most iconic Australian film, dwarfed only by Baz Luhrmann's Australia. I kid,
stop.
Obviously. But there's no other movie that makes a faggot want to like jump on the top of a bus and just throw some fabric like Priscilla.
Yeah, I mean, that image, it's the things that they managed to capture in that film are really spectacular. It's beautiful, the contrast of it. Yeah. And the contrast, too, of like all of this finery and the artifice of drag and like the structural integrity amidst like the wild of the Australian outback is the perfect contrast of images.
Oh, my God.
And in fact, the inspiration was when the director actually saw a drag queen walking down the street after Mardi Gras in like all her like falling apart glory, and her part of the feathers of her boa came off and started rolling away like a tumbleweed. She was like, oh, drag queens in the outback. That's it. That's what it
needs
to be.
Oh my God, that's too funny. Can you imagine like the amount of grease paint they went through? Like how grease paint just melts.
Oh, we're going to get into melting. So before we do, Champagne, just give people like a quick little plot summary of what this is about.
Okay, so essentially this film is about two drag queens and one trans performer who hit the Australian outback to essentially get to a gig that they've been booked for, which seems across the country. I don't know how long it takes to get across that country. To get to the gig, and fun and shenanigans happen throughout, and also intense things happen throughout. But this is what happens when you throw three queers on a bus that's about to break down.
I hereby christen this budget Barbie camper Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
We should also say these three performers, so they are all heterosexual, but they, at the time, Hugo Weaving was starting to become a name, who plays Mitzi the Magnificent. And then you have Terrence Stamp, which I remember my mother being so excited about Terrence Stamp, because the only thing she'd ever seen him in was in these like He-Man macho roles. And here she was playing a transgender person. This is one of Guy Pearce's first like film roles as Felicia Jolly Goodfellow, which is one of the greatest names for a drag performer.
So good. Felicia Jolly Goodfellow is an amazing drag name, but also Guy Pearce is just
so good.
So hot in this
Beautiful movie.
Yeah.
So stunningly gorgeous the whole movie.
And understands how beautiful their behind is. And so you get a lot of shots of her behind.
And also like simultaneously just wants to make you punch them in the face.
Oh yeah, totally.
That's why they put up with her though, right? Because she's so pretty. it's the thing. But I think what's so interesting, a lot of people might not know about this, is of course, Hugo Weaving wasn't quite yet the mega star. Terrence Stamp had a name, but where Guy Pearce was coming from is he was on Neighbours. He was the heartthrob from Neighbours. And so this in Australia, to go and see this performer doing this would have been a complete tonal shift from that, right? And this is also the role, weirdly, that kicked open the door for him to get auditions for LA Confidential in 96, which made him a superstar.
Oh, interesting.
Wow, that's incredible.
The thing about that role is that this is a film about resilience. And it's interesting when you talk to different people about who this movie is about. Who do you, each of you, let's start with you, Shampi. Who do you think the central character of this film is?
I mean, I really do think the central character is the one with the child, whose name I can't remember right now. Bernadette.
Mitzi the Magnificent.
So in my opinion, it's Mitzi's. I can see how it would, I can see how it could be others. But in my opinion, the main line is hers.
Now, I think they want to, I think they want us to think that Tick is the main character of this movie, and it's the whole Tick got the gig. Tick is the whole reason they're traveling across the country. It's all about Tick trying to reconnect to his kid. However, I kind of think this is Bernadette's movie. I think at the end of the day, the character we see the most growth and range from and kind of the most importance of story is Bernadette. There's something about the storyline of like trans acceptance and comfort and finding love as especially like an older trans person in Australia in the 1990s that always kind of trumps the storyline of Tick like reuniting with their child for me. Like by the end of the movie, I'm always focusing on what Bernadette's been through, I think, more than what Tick has experienced. I feel like I'm always left more satisfied by Bernadette's storyline and experience. I think secretly it's Bernadette's movie.
So aside from the boa tumbleweed, this is also based on the life of a drag performer named Cindy Pastel, who has a very conflicting relationship with this film because the character of Tick is very much based on her. She had a wife and she had a child. She took custody of her child later in life. She realized that she had not come out to her child until the two of them were sitting in the theater together and watching the final scene where Hugo Weaving does come out to his child or comes out to his child. And apparently the two of them just sat next to each other and his son held her hand and they just were like, nope, I just know we're okay. And Cindy Pastel was like, oh, okay. So that was little coming out moment with the film. She talks very openly about this, but the conflicting issue here is that she did not sell her life rights. The movie is based on her and she has received no recompense from this, aside from the fact that she can say the movie is based on me. And she does a lot of the documentaries and things like that, talking about it afterwards. There's a great documentary about this called Frock in a Hard Place, which I used as a big point. Isn't that fabulous?
That's so good.
Oh my God. Poor her. All these documentaries are that are like, hey, we still like you to use you for a documentary, but we can pay you a lunch.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure she received some recompense for this. And again, she was able to say, I'm the inspiration for Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. So there was that. But again, this is kind of like Flashdance territory where this is someone's life rights who were taken and weren't exactly recompensed in a way they should have been. So watching that, also a lot of Cindy Pastel stuff. If you want to see her on YouTube, she's there too. And her stuff is really, really special. But I'm with you with Bernadette because this is something that's always interesting to me when you have these, I'm not even going to say heterosexual because I'm going to bring up another actor who had issues playing a character in drag later, that men tend to have is they want to play beautiful women. Dustin Hoffman talked about it when they did Tootsie. Terrence Stamp talked about it playing Bernadette, that she wanted to be beautiful and wasn't actually allowed to see the dailies or herself in a mirror. She just played it and was shocked when she saw the film and herself because she's like, oh my God, I look like an old dog, and was mad about it until she realized what the performance actually was. And then Neil Patrick Harris actually had big issues and a lot of fear playing Hedwig. So,
okay, wait, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt. In the case of Neil Patrick Harris, that is just like internalized homophobia and like what happens when you are fed a silver spoon as a gay kid in a heteropatriarchal world throughout your entire life.
I'm going to put an amen on that. I think it's always really interesting, especially as like two people who have been doing drag for a long time now and like have been performing. I've been doing drag for, it'll be 8 years in August. So little of my drag experience is this kind of like commercialized idea that it's like really scary. It's like really, really scary to finally get in drag. Like the idea that Neil Patrick Harris has had this big narrative of being like, I just really had to take the plunge and, you know, toughen up and really act, really access within myself the, you know, bravery to put on women's clothing. One of my favorite terms ever. And I don't know, I kind of think that kind of self-ascribed bravery is important. And I think, yes, like living a true identity within yourself and expressing that freely is like very brave and very important. And I respect people who are able to get in drag and get out and perform. But for the case of a Hollywood actor being like, I was really scared to take the plunge and get paid, you know, millions of dollars for putting on a skirt and interloping in a field where professionals have been doing this for 30 years. That's what I hear when I hear that. So when people are like, oh, I'm afraid to dress like a woman, I'm like, oh, okay, sure.
I think the interesting thing for me is they want to be pretty women. If they're going to be a woman, they have to be attractive. And I think that's fascinating to me.
Oh, like, what's so up ridiculous. With that?
Yeah.
Like, what's up with that? But I think, like, I think it's psychologically, and I think, like, Freud would probably attest to this, that there's, like, probably something deeply ingrained psychologically that most men just, like, want to be able to fuck themselves.
Ah, interesting.
And so I think you know, it's like how men always joke where they're like, if I could suck my own dick, I'd never leave the house. It's like, so I think men just want to be a pretty woman. So theoretically, if they were a separate person that they could fuck, they'd want to fuck them.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that. And it's, I think what's interesting to me about the Bernadette character, though, is that moving aside the fact she looks like an old dog, which I don't think she does. She looks like a woman who has taken care of herself and dresses very elegantly. And her facial expressions are my favorite in the drag performances. She's so committed. I think for me, the fact that that role is played as someone with so much dignity, who clearly has been through so much shit and is going to take the high road in everything. Her comebacks are so clear and delivered so beautifully.
So on point.
Now listen here, you mullet. Why don't you just light your tampon and blow your box apart? Because it's the only bang you're ever gonna get, sweetheart.
And the only time she loses her shit is when Felicia Jolly Goodfellow dead names her in public.
You're a bloody marvel, Bernie.
Bernadette, please.
What's that?
My name isn't Bernie.
She said her name isn't Bernie. It's Ralph.
So it's really, I think it's really a groundbreaking performance. And again, non-trans actors playing, you know, trans people as a thing, obviously. Now we know, no bueno. But in terms of representation, I don't think this is bad representation. Stop me if I'm wrong.
No, I mean, I can't speak to any experience aside from being a drag performer who embraces their gender fluidity and exists working with a lot of trans people and has throughout my career. But I really think, like, Terrence Stamp's portrayal of Bernadette is, it's the fact that you use the word dignity, Becky. It's exactly that. It's such a dignified portrayal of an older queer person, an older trans woman that has such an inherent strength and beauty to it. Like, those shots of Bernadette in that kind of, like, white flowy sundress towards the end of the movie when everything's kind of wrapping up. She's so stunning, just like casually beautiful and so, like, so sitting proudly in her femininity that, like, I don't know, it's always felt like a really beautiful portrayal of a trans woman to me, especially just because she's no bullshit as well. It's never, like, a caveat to her personality that she's trans. She's like, deal with me.
She also has to come to terms with herself. You mentioned earlier that this is about her journey because she talks about it. The movie kicks off with her partner, Trumpet, who I believe is like 24, 25. He asphyxiates on his own peroxide. It's amazing as he's dyeing his hair. But even she talks about, to find someone to love you and take care of you, you are a novelty. And then when she meets Bob, she's no longer a novelty because Bob sees her for who she is.
Yeah.
And that's why she decided
Bob,
to stay.
Who, by the way, is also in Muriel's
Wedding. That's right. Well, okay. So we should probably talk about Bill Hunter because Bill Hunter, and we will get into Bill Hunter. Bill Hunter's career is basically as long as the Australian film industry itself.
Wow.
He started back in like the 60s. He is iconic. And so the fact that they got Bill Hunter, who did film this simultaneously with Muriel, like they had to keep flying him back.
Oh, wow. Life. Okay.
Funny.
But he actually, this movie is like bargain basement. I think they made it for like $1.6 million. Like there was no money for this film. He actually believed so much in what this film was saying. He took a cut rate for it because he was like, I need to be in it. And his appearance also gave it that air of legitimacy in Australia so they could get that kind of distribution for it.
Cool. That's amazing.
Nice.
It's wild how far he can swing from being so likable in Priscilla and so charming and kind of like, oh, this like sweet man just wants to protect these people and like do what's right, to being like abjectly horrifying in Muriel's
Wedding. The worst, you know, like
horrifyingly awful.
His relationship with his wife is kind of fascinating to me, though, because obviously she manipulates. You see, okay, this is okay. Well, this becomes a broader subject. How do you feel? I've never liked watching "This Is Why I'm Gay" stuff. That always makes me. It always feels very reductive to me. And I think this film plays it a little tongue in cheek in that, like, yeah, I'm going to trace it back to this one point, but we all know that's not it, right? But I think maybe for a mainstream audience, they might not see it that way, especially because it is very stereotypical. Like, I was abused as a child. Like, I always wanted to play with the dolls. What did you think of those moments where you do see that, like, this is how I ended up here? And same with him going back and being like, my wife got me drunk and tricked me into marrying her, so I take her back to Australia.
I mean, the whole conversations around consent about that and his relationship with his wife in this movie is very, very odd. And like,
odd.
it's kind of one of the more, that whole period of the movie, that whole section of the movie when they're in Cooper Petty and you're learning more about Bob and his wife, is it kind of takes me out of it a little bit because it's too it's almost too real.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? That it's like this is a little too believable that for someone to gain landed immigrant status in a country that they would like marry and then become full of rage. Like, it's just something that happens, unfortunately.
No, I'm there with you. I think, like, the point of view of seeing that, like, initially you're shown that he keeps her down, that, like, she just wants to sing, she wants to perform, she wants to be the center of attention. And he's like, nope, even though she obviously does very well for herself in the entertainment industry in a very specific niche in this town. You know, she seems to enjoy it. Why not? You know, but then you see what she did to him. So it's like, oh, is that the balancing point? Is that why?
Yeah. Like, are they trying to explain away their relationship by the fact that it's rooted in the idea that she drugged him and things like that and convinced her to marry him? Yeah, it's a weird kind of push-pull they try to establish between two not great ways of treating humans.
Well, I want to bring us into something a little bit lighter, because let's talk about these performance numbers, which, let's be honest, like, aside from all of, like, the drama and everything else about them being gay, this is what really sold it to the mainstream that people
love. Well, and they do such a good job at that. Like, they hook you in right at the beginning with just this, like, glamour of it all. And then they also kind of like just hit you a little bit with a beer bottle over the head at the same time with it.
Yeah.
Just like break you out of that fantasy. So like, just to start with that is amazing. I mean, I think these are probably my first introduction to drag performances. So they kind of like, they go down as like, now and whenever camp drag comes up, camp, that's every facial expression, every bit of performance comes. That's where my mind goes, is straight to that. Because they're so good.
I think that one of the joys of this movie is that it kind of really accurately captures drag, which I feel like is a hard thing for a lot of drag movies to do. Like, even when we look at something like Tu Wong Fu, like the experience of this like massive pageant and runway that seems to be one night only and doesn't have any actual like performance numbers in it, like, doesn't seem as real of a drag show to me as Priscilla.
I don't know. Ruby and AJ and the Kid, or whatever that movie's called, that TV show's called, does a good job.
Yeah, AJ and the Queen does a great job of showing what drag is actually like.
Oh my God.
You know, everyone knows that once we all become performers, we are assigned a child to take care of, take from gig to gig, and have them scream at us.
Which they were kind of touching on in Priscilla.
Exactly.
Well, I think the other thing I really like is that you get to see them rehearse and you see how hard it actually is what they're doing.
Yes.
Like, it's not just these amazing things came out of nowhere, right?
I love that it contextualizes it as work as well. Like, I like anytime drag is contextualized in a film as a career and an artistic outlet and a path of work, and like also for some people like a financial path of work, instead of just being like a hobby, a dirty little secret, a fetish, something that distracts me from the rest of my life. I like that it can be shown as, it's like, here are three hardworking people who this is their job and this is what they do and they're very good at it. Like, I like that kind of normalization of just being able to be like, these are entertainers. These are employees.
I actually, like, on the note of, like, Australians seemed backlash that wasn't an accurate representation seems odd, because like, even if you're looking at the subject matter of the film, to me it hits most plot points of like a lot of plot points that like queer people face, like challenges that we face, and like you hitting things over the head in film doesn't work. So like, it's not like they could have been like in the bus and suddenly like, oh, I tried to have sex the other day, but it's like illegal. Like, that's too over the head. That's not gonna happen, right? Like,
a cop interrupted me the other day while I was penetrating.
Yeah, you know, like that's not like really what how it's gonna be portrayed. So like, you get them in these subtle ways, and like, the first time I watched Priscilla, I was 18. So and all the like, I was like, oh yeah, that's what it's like being gay in a small, like, I just equated the outback to small town like Alberta, and I was like, this is what it's like. You live your life and then these things happen and you have to deal with it.
The metaphor of the film, I think, is the most powerful to me, and how brilliant, because the further away they get from the city, the more danger they're in, and the worse the things that happen to them become until they get to Alice Springs. And that speech that, again, Bernadette gives, that is just so incredible to Felicia Jolly Goodfellow after she's taken some substances and been very unwise, is just about the city protecting you, and like maybe like it keeps us in, but it also keeps them out, is just such an interesting idea of the gay experience and the escape to the city and to these neighborhoods. Even then, you're clustered within these particular neighborhoods.
It's funny. We all sit around mindlessly slagging off that vile stinkhole of a city. But in its own strange way, it takes care of us. I don't know if that ugly wall of suburbia has been put there to stop them getting in or us getting out.
Yeah, completely. That rings very true for me and my Toronto experience. And I think Champagne and I have had a lot of conversations about this over the years of what we hate Toronto for parts of it. You know what I mean? I think it's part of the experience of being a cool young Torontonian. Actually, no, a cool Torontonian of any age to be like, I fucking hate it here. But that being said, you will also defend it till the death and understand that it saved you from a life of the mundane and the boring and feeling trapped in a certain environment. You know, Shams and I have had a lot of conversations about growing up like that. And Champagne is more rural and small town in her upbringing than I am. But still, it's like I didn't grow up in the city. So having it kind of explained like that, it's funny to put it in terms of ABBA. I really love this ABBA song called I Am the City. Do you know it? It's from their Even More Gold album. It's just really sweet, and it's about just being like, it's sung from the perspective of a city that loves you. I mean, ABBA is huge in both of these movies. I'm just going to try to find the lyric that I really, really like. It's just in the chorus. I'm the street you walk, the language you talk. I am the city. The skyline is me and the energy. I am the city. The famous hotels and the cocktail bars and the funny smells and the turmoil, the cars, the people. The air that you're breathing is me. Yes, I am the city. You let me be. I like love that song, and I think it's very sweet and cute. And this movie and the way Bernadette explains that really feels kind of the same, except for the fact that Bernadette hates ABBA. My one huge issue with this movie is that the one character that, in my opinion, should love ABBA the most hates ABBA.
Oh my God.
Honestly, she's too old for ABBA. And when we talk about Muriel's Wedding, I'm going to get into the Australian relationship with ABBA, but she's too old for ABBA. That's the issue. She's the supreme.
Totally.
Yeah, like one of my favorite Bernadette quotes in the entire movie is like, I'll join this conversation on the proviso that we stop bitching about people talking about wigs, dresses, bus sizes, penises, drugs, nightclubs, and bloody ABBA. Yeah.
So good. Also have to talk about, of course, the costumes, because this won the Academy Award that year for Lizzie Gardner and Tim Chappell. And if you go watch the video, it's very funny, their acceptance speech. I believe Lizzie Gardner ends with, we have to go off and cry with dignity. Please excuse us. Like, it's pretty good.
I love
good.
That so much.
And she also shows up in a dress made out of American Express gold cards, which are stunning and like just shows you the resourcefulness.
That's her Oscars dress?
That's her Oscars dress.
That's fierce.
It's gorgeous. And here's who they beat: Bullets Over Broadway, Little Women, Maverick, and Queen Margot.
Good.
So they call the flip-flop dress that Hugo Weaving wears. They call it the thong dress. That is a $7 dress.
I did know that, actually, that it's, like, put together with hot glue and things like that. It's one of my favorite kind of drag on the fly, on the cheap, like, rags to riches kind of things. Same with, like, Jerry Halliwell's famous Union Jack dress was a tea towel sewn onto a tube dress, you know? I love things like that that are so clear with their intent and their message that what if you don't want to even like it doesn't matter what it's made of, it doesn't matter what the material is. I love what I'm seeing, you know.
Yeah, honestly, I mean, listen, this show that does such a good job at making any garment look good, like they make one piece of fabric just give your entire gay wet dreams the send off it needs.
Let's talk about the fabric,
please. Do
it's just like so iconic.
I feel like drag performers everywhere, this has to be universal, because every time I watch Priscilla and I see the image of just a beautiful human with like 60 feet of billowing silver fabric behind them while opera blasts, I'm like, I feel nothing but pure unadulterated envy.
Yeah. I've seen the musical. I've seen it, and it's like at that moment they have this contraption on the top of the bus that just extends over top of the audience. So they're in like the middle of the auditorium on this platform, and this like fabric is just like going over top of the entire audience and like into the stage. It's like, regardless of which production, it's just like movie or Broadway, like that moment is just always going to be so, it has to be so like dramatic.
Yeah.
They almost didn't get that shot. It was, they had one day to do it. Like they had to shoot this tight. They had spent so much time by hand. That piece of fabric is sewn to the extent that it is. It took them like hours and hours and hours, and they get out in the desert and there's no wind. And so as the bus is going, it's just like dragging behind. And the production manager is like, look, Hugo Weaving is in trouble. Like, this is dangerous. You can't do this. It might get caught under the bus and hurt him. So they were like, okay. So just as he was like gathering it up for them to like take it down, the wind picked up and they were like, okay, go, and they got the shot. And it's like, yeah, it's like perfect.
That must have been so stressful setting up a crane and waiting for that. Oh my god.
But I do want to talk about the Aboriginal characters in this, because they almost weren't in it. They almost didn't get funding for it because people actually thought them putting that in there was racist.
Australians are so weird.
Their racial relations, especially with their Aboriginal people, is very interesting. And then musical eliminates the Aboriginal people altogether from it. The reason being is that they said they could not find a performer to be able to perform that well enough. I call bullshit. And they also said in international versions, who would play those characters? It's better not to have them at all than to whitewash those characters.
Wow, it's almost like you just hire Indigenous actors across every country you're in.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's almost like by saying, oh, I don't want to whitewash this part, you also say, so I'm going to go through with the planned erasure of Indigenous actors in every country that this musical could be put on.
The amount of ways this movie almost didn't get made as well to me. My personal favorite is they were turned down by almost every funding body in Australia, and one of them had a note attached to it that said, this film is deeply shallow and should never be made.
You know that was a straight person.
This movie is so not shallow.
Yeah.
Like, I can imagine describing this movie as a lot of things. I could imagine, like, funding companies thinking it was, like, frivolous or over the top or too camp or et cetera. But not shallow. That's not the critique I would give it to absolve it of my funding. I wouldn't be like, this movie's shallow. Like, it just feels like such an odd
We're not
choice.
Paying for pom-poms, people. That's not happening.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to our next film. When we come back, we're going to be, of course, looking at Muriel's Wedding, which to me is as close to perfect as possible. It is better than an ABBA song. That's coming up after the break.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
To look at a poster for Muriel's wedding with beaming Toni Collette dressed in an elaborate wedding gown, her face turned upwards into a shower of colored confetti, you'd think you were about to watch the biggest feel-good comedy of the year. The trailer tells the same story, joke after joke and jubilant ABBA soundtrack and the tagline, "Success is the best revenge." In fact, the trailer ends on the mean girl character telling Muriel she looks beautiful on her wedding day. Like, that's the way the movie ends. Oh boy, moviegoers, we're in for a surprise. I mean, I remember my mom watching this in the other room when I was a kid, and I could hear her alternating between laughing and crying and always pausing so that she could finish doing both. And when I watched it for the first time, that was honestly my reaction as well. I know you both had different reactions to it on your first time viewing, but my God, the first time I saw this, my life was changed. Dan Wiley, who plays Perry in the movie, has described this as the saddest comedy ever made. But still, it's ABBA. Again, amazing costumes, and it's two actresses who are too good for this world, Rachel Griffiths and Toni Collette. Muriel's Wedding, my darlings. Muriel's Wedding. Allison, talk to us about what this is about.
What isn't this about? Muriel has terrible friends, spends all her days listening to ABBA music to escape her life, and lives in a town that is unfortunately titled Porpoise Spit, and has a corrupt politician dad, and who like is constantly belittling her wife, and she has all these siblings. I think there's like five of them in total. And then she goes to her like heinous friend's wedding and sees her husband cheating on her with like one of her best friends. And then they all like break up with her as a friend, and then they go on a vacation without her. And then she gets a blank check from her parents to buy things necessary for a new job they think she's starting. But instead, she steals $12,000 from her parents and goes on this vacation, then moves to Sydney and starts a new life for herself. It's all about her journey of meeting an old friend on that vacation and then moving to Sydney together, and her becoming a new person and constantly wanting to reinvent herself, with the common through line of consistently always just wanting to get married.
That's success, because that's the, and that's what she says to her mother.
I'm going to be a success, Mom. I'm going to get married and I'm going to be a success.
And it's like, well, then what happens after that? So I think that, and then you find out what happens after that.
You sure do.
Well, which is kind of interesting, because like, what happens after that? Look at your mother's wedding.
Yeah. That's, oh my God. I love this movie so much. I think it's so close to
me
perfect
too.
Because for me, it rides that line so closely of being absolutely hilarious and totally fucking devastating,
yeah,
but believable in it. And these characters, like in a lot of Australian movies, are over the top. They're like people that like you simultaneously believe do and do not exist.
He said he was having an affair.
Who are you?
Rose Biggs.
Rose Biggs?
Well, he said they don't sleep together. She only sucks him off. Out of respect for me.
Yeah, Aussies, like, I was talking with my friends, like, lol, not to mince my words, but, like, Aussies are kind of trashy. And, like, but when you're, like, portraying, but they're also really good at, like, they're already kind of, like, a characterization of whiteness. So then when you, like, write it in as comedy, it's like this extra layer of just like them making fun of themselves, which is like really fucking hilarious.
Yeah, I will say that one of the key components to Australian humor is the ability to be able to first and foremost destroy Australians, like mock Australia. I think that's kind of like number one, is like figure out how to mock Australia. And then number two is, numbers two through five are awful things.
Yeah.
As someone pointed, I read a review, I'm sorry, I don't remember who it was, but someone made the point that the reason why Americans became so interested in Australian movies about suburbia, which this is that Australian suburbia is portrayed as so differently from American suburbia, because American suburbia is like bland and white picket fences and boring, whereas this is like intensely garish colors and weird people who are talking very loudly. Like it's, and you have that in like the television series Kath and Kim from Australia as well, where there are suburbanites playing up like how weird these people are with constant fat jokes, unfortunately. But like that's the that's how that that kind of idea works. And it's very different for us, and it's very fun.
Yeah, it honestly is.
My theory is that Americans love any movie from Australia where the seasons are referenced by date. So I think it's all just because she goes, when are you getting married? And Muriel goes, September. And she goes, spring. And there was something about watching it and her going spring that I was like, no.
So this is also a queer icon film for a lot of people. Toni Collette has talked about how this is the movie that she says she gets the most gays screaming at her about. Like they will track her down in the street just like be like,
so good in this movie.
She's like, incredible.
It's obviously like a gay, so my friend was like, why is this movie a gay iconic, like an iconic gay movie? And I was like, oh, I don't really know. And then we turned it on and the first still is just these women screaming. And I was like, oh, okay, so there's our answer.
Because I actually think it's two reasons. I think it's number one, Muriel is all about lies. And she has to, only when she's able to tell the truth is she set free. And then the second reason is it's about chosen family.
Yeah.
And she gets to choose to go away with Rachel Griffiths and form their own family together when they don't want to be with their actual families, right? And I think that's the big reason people are like, oh, that messaging for me.
Self-worth,
I think that's absolutely true. And I also think there's an element to drag queens loving this movie because Muriel kind of has like Sydney drag, you know what I mean? It's like
interesting.
She goes and becomes her like Sydney character of Muriel, you know, she even has like a her drag name.
She does. Yeah.
But on top of that, I think queer people at their base love watching two women fight while two other people do choreography to Waterloo. I think that's what makes this a gay movie.
That's so good.
And also, I'm sure because of Daniel LePain, who plays David Van Arkel, he is very pretty in this movie.
He's so hot.
They shoot him so fetishistically, too, when he comes out of the water like a Bond girl. And you're like, man.
Wow. Oh, I love objectifying straight men.
Yeah, it's fine. He got paid.
It's fine. Yeah. He got a good career off of this.
Yeah.
The other thing this film very much fetishizes that we should probably talk about is ABBA. And as we mentioned, the last movie has a lot of ABBA in it. This one does too. Apparently, they did not get permission to use the ABBA songs until 2 weeks before they began shooting.
Wow.
Otherwise,
as a producer, that would stress me the fuck out.
Oh, I'm sure it did for them too. They were going to use the Village People otherwise, which
I wonder, like, would it have been the same movie as like her crying in front of her mirror and then suddenly looking up and it's like, ba 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 ba.
But, like, the dancing queen is, like, such a perfect metaphor for what she's going through. Like, it's really heartbreaking.
It's true.
Because it could be any man, right? The guy is here somewhere, and she keeps looking for that man, which is why she's attached to it. And she has that incredible line, since I moved in with you, I haven't listened to ABBA once because my life is now better than an ABBA song.
And then she turns it on a few minutes later, and you're like,
God, it's
oh, my God. I have to geek out for a moment. Like, yeah. Toni Collette's range of emotions is so fucking good. Oh my God, she's so good. Like the fact that she, like the crying that she can do, when it's like so over the top and camp, but also so rooted in truth.
Yes.
Is like so heartbreaking. And I'm like, Toni Collette, I want to be you. I want to marry you. I just want to like drink Toni Collette.
I had the exact same thought when they like kind of break up with her in that like club restaurant and she's like heavy heaving sobbing. I think it's supposed to be funny and I was watching it like almost choking up being like, this is like too honest. I feel like I'm genuinely watching someone like really have their heart break and like consider so much like struggle in themselves.
The best moment of that scene though is before the breakup even happens, which you know is coming. She's got her big like fruity cocktail drink and they say to her, come on girls, let her finish her orgasm,
her screaming orgasm. It's just she's drinking a screaming orgasm, at least let her finish her orgasm.
And then they watch her in complete silence yeah. as she just drains this drink, just staring at her. It's magnificent. Well,
and then,
so horrible.
And then they make fun of her for thinking she's trying to steal the moment, which is ridiculous. But the other thing is that I think it's constantly shown that even though Muriel does what is like objectively a quote unquote like a bad thing to like steal money from her family.
You're terrible, Muriel.
I'm so good. But that it's always shown that at any moment when her friends are being heinous to her, which is so early in the movie, she has this ace in the hole of knowing that her other friend slept with the main mean girl's husband. Like, she could tell her that at any time. She could lay that information on her at any time. And she constantly makes the choice not to. And I think that's really interesting to note how much that endears us all to Muriel without even maybe realizing is that she actively makes a choice to still be a decent person when hurt and just like kicked.
That's the thing that I think you are able to continue to love her. That's a great point, Allison, because she does, when she has to make the right choices, she more often than not does, with the exception of when she abandons yeah. Rachel Griffiths for her own success, which is like, yeah. oh my God, that yeah. part breaks me every fucking time.
Oh, it's so sad. It's so good.
I have to go. Good luck with what's his name.
Where are you going?
Where do you think? Back to Pauper's Spit with Mum. We're catching the bus out tonight.
I don't want you to.
Well, you should have thought of that before you gave up on me. I couldn't pay all the rent without you. I couldn't even do the shopping. I needed help. I needed a friend.
I mean, I don't want you to go back by bus. I bought you 2 plane tickets.
But I want to talk about P.J. Hogan and Jocelyn Morehouse, who are a married couple. P.J. Hogan wrote and directed this film, and Jocelyn Morehouse is his wife who helped him produce it. And they are a very rare instance of a married couple who both make films together and alternate who gets to direct and who produces. I think there's a very good reason why P.J. Hogan, off of this film, was then asked to direct My Best Friend's Wedding. It's a very similar mm-hmm. vibe. So it's like, yeah, that, and that's why My Best Friend's Wedding is so good.
I'm a huge fan of My Best Friend's Wedding. I've loved that movie since I was, like, way too young to like that movie, but I always loved it. But my takeaway as an adult rewatching it on like a semi-regular basis is always that I'm like, why do I like Julia Roberts' character? She's so
vicious,
awful. The entire plotline of this movie is her trying to do it. Terrible thing, but I love her.
Like Muriel, she has had terrible things done to her. The yeah. way her boyfriend in that film treats her is, or not the boyfriend, the man who she's trying yeah. to get back, the best friend, is not nice to her and keeps no. putting her also in very sexually inappropriate positioning, like the whole getting changed thing. We're talking about another movie. We'll have you guys back when we need to talk about My Best Friend's Wedding, obviously.
I would love to talk about My Best Friend's Wedding. Oh my God.
This film is based on a true story. P.J. Hogan came from an incredibly abusive family, like more so than what you see in the film. What you're seeing in the film is like a very emotionally abusive family, which for some people, if they're watching this, I don't know if they would even recognize it's abusive. It just feels awkward. But like, this is straight up, you're useless. You're all, I mean, when Bill Hunter does that speech to them in public, the Chinese restaurant, and tells them they're all useless. And it's just heartbreaking.
Sits around the house like a dead weight, watching TV, sleeping all day, getting arrested at weddings. You're useless. You're all useless. Useless, no opus.
It's that and more that his family was going through. And P.J. Hogan escaped to, he was one of the older siblings, and he escaped to Sydney. And then his sister did that. She got $12,000 from their mother in order to buy cosmetics from their father's mistress, of course, who everybody knew was the mistress except for the mom, and then stole the money, went on vacation, and then when she got caught, ran away to Sydney. So it's pretty amazing that that actually happened. But P.J. Hogan said immediately, I knew why she did it. Like, there was never a moment of, like, why would you do this? Yeah. Like, no, I know exactly why you did it.
Yeah.
What an interesting thing for a filmmaker to take that point of view. Because in somebody else's hands, she would have been the villain. But she's not. Here, she's the hero. And you understand yeah. completely why she takes off. It's like a heist movie, but on a small scale. It's like a comedy heist movie.
That is kind of true. I do love the cut when they realize what Muriel's done and thus like kind of present to the audience exactly what Muriel's done in more plain terms. And it cuts to them just like celebrating after the Waterloo performance in the pool, yeah. like wetting her wig.
There's this beautiful shot like, of just like their two faces in that moment of like Rachel Griffiths and Toni Collette. And they're just like leaning on each other, but then like on the corner of the screen you just see the top of the Moët, and I'm like, I love that. Like, Moët just got this amazing advertisement, this huge ass bottle.
I was just going to say the experience of like lying down somewhere, drinking late at night, smoking and singing ABBA songs is very near and dear to my heart. Like an ABBA themed after party. An ABBA after party is something I've been lucky enough to experience many times in my life.
On a weekly basis since moving to Toronto.
Yeah, I would say between 2015 and 2017, yeah. Like every other night.
Well, talking about ABBA, we should probably get into why do Australians love ABBA so much? There is an article I read about this in the Sydney Morning Herald, that's the paper, and they talked about when their first album came out, Sydney was in like absolute turmoil, very similar to what was happening in the United States, where the Vietnam War had just ended, so a lot of people were really messed up. Their government got overthrown because of corruption charges. They had to like completely replace the government. People were not in a great place. They were just so excited to have something that was joyous and fun, and people really grabbed onto it. So when Fernando hit the airwaves, it stayed on the top of the charts for 14 weeks. It beat the Beatles' Hey Jude, which had the previous record of 13 weeks. Wow.
I love that.
Yeah, people really grabbed onto it. And it's so much so that when they showed up for their first, like, tour, the prime minister had to, like, get special favors pulled in so he could get tickets for his family. Nicole Kidman talks about it on a regular basis as being a defining moment for herself because she was there at the airport seeing them. And she's like, they took time to sign papers and things. And she says, I've always tried to be gracious to my fans in that same way. So it's like, wow, this is really influential for people.
Wow. That's wild. I didn't know that.
It's very cool. I've done some reading about this before, about how the fact that Australia was one of the first major places they could tour, that they had an audience that would want them. And so, like, as a band, their first kind of rock star experience of having that big moment of people greeting them at a plane was Australia. And so they had, like, a symbiotic relationship, like, with Australia for the rest of their career, where they always factored in going to Australia and, like, Australian releases for singles. And I find that just like so interesting that Australia was just like, no, you're ours. We love you. Like, we love you so much.
It's the costumes. It's the tax. The tax purposes costumes. You know, they dress like that, right? Because of tax purposes.
Oh my God. Totally.
Did you know this, Shampi?
No, that's so funny.
Under Swedish law, you can't write off your outfits if it's something you could wear every day. So they had to make their outfits so outlandish that it would be nothing they could wear on the street. So that's why they dress the way they dress, is for tax purposes.
I love that.
It's amazing. Pretty amazing. It's so
funny. But I do have to say, like, this film is actually hilarious. It, like, just really coming for white people again. I'm going to bring that up. There's, like, the white woman calling the cops, which I just thought was, like, so funny, and how she's, like, this weird thread throughout the entire thing. But also there's this moment with the dad where he's talking about, it's, like, this weird premonition. It's, like, talking about how he lost the mail-in vote.
the postal vote. Yes. I want to see the movie about that. No, he lost the postal workers.
Oh, it was the postal workers. I thought it was the postal vote. And I was like, oh my God, just like Trump. That's so fucking funny.
That's funny, Champagne. I thought the same thing as you.
No, because later there's a reference that, like, it's because of those stupid women at the post office that he lost. So apparently some of these women at the post office had some sort of vendetta against him, which is also very funny. Just thinking about what he possibly did to these women at the post office.
It's wonderful for Deirdre to give you work. She's a wonderful person. I don't care what anyone else says.
What who says?
All those people who've never liked Dad. Those greenies and those terrible women at the post office.
I thought it was very 2020, actually. Mm-hmm.
It's also amazing to me that this, like a lot of other Australian films, almost didn't get made, even though it made this massive international hit. And they actually had to use their buddy, Jane Campion, who had just won an Oscar for The Piano. They went to film school with her and were like, hi, we have this movie. We're trying to get funding. Can you help us out? And she was like, yeah, let me introduce you to this French company that produced my movie. And they loved it. And so this was actually produced by a French company, which is, of course, they get it. Of course.
Yeah. Of course they do.
Justice for Toni Collette. Toni Collette should be in more things. Toni Collette should be in everything.
I agree. And less Hereditary. Less sad for Toni Collette. You know, I'd like to see her in more comedies.
I think every listener right now should just drop what they're doing and go watch United States of Terra.
Although
I'm not sure how it holds up in 2021, but like, It's so good.
I was just going to say the same thing. You stole the words out of my mouth.
Oh, she's so good in it. She's so, like...
The range. Anyway, yeah. I love her.
Can we just say more Diablo Cody collaborations?
Yeah.
Let's just end with that. Well, thank you so much to both of you for joining us this episode. Alice in Chains, how do people find you and your work?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. You can find me on Instagram at Alice in Chains, same way it's spelled in probably the description of this episode, A-L-L-Y-S-I-N-C-H-A-Y-N-E-S. And you can catch me broadcasting and producing weekly with a cool collective of queer artists, such as Champagne on speakeasy-tv.com, the Speakeasy Queer Network channel that I help produce with a bunch of other amazing queer folks, including Lizzie Renault, owner of Speakeasy Tattoo Shop. We just moved to a new studio and we've got a bunch of new Pride programming coming out. So yeah, check it out. It's amazing. We've got content many nights of the week where our schedule is just like filling up more and more. And we've got RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars 6 starting on June 24th. I haven't even talked to Champagne about it. I'm like, if you want to do it, let me know. Anyway, that's where you can find me.
Excellent. Thank you. And Champagne, how do people find you?
They can find me on Instagram under Champagne_Pappy. I'm also on TikTok _Champagne_. That's that. Keep an eye to the ground. I have a web series coming out shortly. And then you can also catch both Allison and I on the first season of CBC's Queens. And hopefully for a second season as well.
Yeah, Queens is delightful if people haven't checked it out. Talk about high camp. Once again, thank you so much to both of you for joining us. And you can join us next week where we're going to a little town called Bedrock. Twitch. That's right, it's the Flintstones. And of course, we're going to be talking about that fantastic Elizabeth Taylor cameo.
Yes!
That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to follow, rate, and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, @HollywoodSuite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. On 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite On Demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted and produced by Becky Shrimpton. Produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland, and featured Allison Chains and Champagne as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagné. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.